welcome to a special episode of Two Lady Focus Podcast. This is the Partial Historians.
And we're talking today with Liv from Let's Talk About Myths, Baby.
I think we should actually do it how she does it. Dr. G, you ready? Let's talk about myths, baby.
Let's talk about... Oh, you don't want to keep going. Okay. Yeah. Damn.
Hello. I love when people sing it and I don't have to.
We're so excited to be talking to you today as another person who is very enthusiastic about all things ancient.
Yes, I mean, I love talking to others about this exact thing. It's so wonderful to have other people, especially women, be doing things like this about the wonderful ancients.
Exactly. So today we thought we would combine forces on something a little Greek, Dr. G.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure that I'm ready. I'm a bit of a Roman historian.
just a little bit.
Yeah, but I'm willing to dive in. Where are we heading, Liv?
Well, we're going to who is originally Greek, but let's be honest, her best stories come from Rome, Medusa.
Ooh.
Very true. We wouldn't dispute that at all.
Yeah, look. Okay, so we're into the kinky snake action. Excellent.
So Medusa is, I mean, she is everywhere, like trying to, you know, you look at her, not just the myths about her, but the way those myths have been used and reappropriated over the years. There is so much to get through, and I don't think we'll get through it all today. But why don't we start with just like a very basic rundown of who Medusa was. Liv, can you give us some basic details?
I absolutely can. Medusa is a Gorgon. There are three Gorgons, but she's the only one who's mortal. Her two sisters, whose names I'm not going to try to remember off the top of my head or pronounce, are the ones who are immortal, making Medusa a little bit special. Their description varies depending on what you're reading. The Greek makes them a lot more monstrous than the Roman. Well, it depends which Greek, I suppose. But in the overall, Medusa's beautiful, but also has snake hair and turns you into stone with a single look.
That's a potent type of seduction.
Yeah. And how she got to be that way, there are multiple stories.
Yeah, there are varying accounts of how she ended up with the snakes and how she ended up petrifying people.
Mm.
I'm interested, Liv, in what your favorite version of the becoming of Medusa's story that you enjoy.
Well, yeah, I think you'll appreciate this, but Ovid is my favorite in as many things as possible. So I would say Ovid's version is my favorite, even if it isn't, you know, as original and Greek as some of the other takes on Medusa.
This is fantastic because Ovid is literally the source I read.
I mean, Ovid is the one I know best. I actually this morning picked up Apollodorus and Hesiod just so I could have an idea of what the Greeks actually said about her, because I know the Ovid one so well that I was like, oh, I'm going to completely forget what Greeks actually thought about Medusa.
She does seem to be quite a scary figure from the Greeks' perspective. There's a few references to Gorgon figures in Homer's Iliad, and the fearful, terrifying aspect seems to be the real focus in that early sort of work on the Gorgons. Not Medusa specifically, but the sisters as a collective.
Yeah, I feel like she's always a lot scarier when it's part of that Gorgon collective. Like, the Gorgons to me seem scarier than Medusa by herself, even though she's by far the most famous aspect of them.
And it's kind of interesting, actually, isn't there? There are kind of two threads that we're talking about here, and one is Medusa herself, like as a person and the myths around her, and the other is her kind of afterlife, I suppose, as the head of Medusa, which has its own. It has its own stories and uses and purposes. And it's kind of weird, but those two things are not necessarily, like, you can definitely have people mention the head of Medusa without giving you the whole backstory about, like, how did it come to be? Why is it a weapon?
Where did the body go?
Yeah.
What happened to the body after the head was removed? That's my favorite.
Look, yeah. Look, Ma, no hands.
Yeah. I've still got the power.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because, I mean, even in ancient Greece, the head was used as, like, a form of protection for so long. It just, the Gorgon head kind of everywhere as a protective sort of talisman.
Yeah, there's a real sort of ubiquity of the head itself, this Gorgon head, and presumably it's Medusa, although the story sort of gets fleshed out more later.
Mm.
Oh, fleshed out was bad.
Okay. Right. I thought you were doing that on purpose.
No, I caught myself halfway through. But the Atropu traic sort of like evil eye warding off feature. Sometimes those Medusas that appear on shields or appear in sort of floor mosaics, they don't have snakes for hair necessarily. Like some of the features sort of develop over time.
Well, and they change, and they do change. Like there's not one like linear story that you can follow in terms of, well, first it started out like this, and then it started to be portrayed like this, and then it started to be portrayed like this. It's you know, we see a real mixture when we start to look at all the different surviving representations, and of course God knows what the other representations which didn't survive look like. We can only go with what we got.
One of them is the one that turns you to stone.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. But given that we're talking about the snake heads and that sort of thing, I thought we might talk about probably one of the more popular versions of how Medusa becomes one of these Gorgons, which does focus a little bit on her hair.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. So a popular version, which I think our listeners would probably be familiar with, is that Medusa was potentially either a priestess of Athena or was going to worship in Athena's temple. Or maybe even more complicated, she just happened to catch the eye of Poseidon, god of the sea and other things, and she sought refuge from him in Athena's temple, thinking that this goddess, you know, this very powerful virgin goddess, might actually protect her. And whatever happened in there, it's not pleasant to think about. But I mean, some versions might suggest that she was seduced, but I think the more popular one is that she was raped by Poseidon.
Oh yeah. Liv, do you want to weigh in here? What's the narrative surrounding this moment with Poseidon?
I think it depends on who you read and how that translation has been translated, right? It's like, I mean, there's so, I think obviously she was raped. But then you get into how the men wanted to write about something like that and whether they wanted to use a kind of terminology like that or just imagine, well, if Poseidon wanted to have sex with her, obviously she wanted it too. So we don't need to talk about it like anything else. Like in, I want to say, Hesiod, she just lay with him. And that's all they say, right? They so often use that, or it's translated as that term, and whatever the Greek might have been, unfortunately I don't read it. But, you know, lay with Poseidon versus a rape by Poseidon.
Yes, it's very euphemistic, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the sort of the through line of my entire podcast is like, but what would it be if it hadn't been interpreted by men over millennia? You know, what was it if you weren't a man jotting down this story? How would you have actually seen it and interpreted it? Because I think it's pretty clear in a lot of them that it was definitely not consensual. And then especially, that's made even more visceral when you think of Athena being or punishing Medusa, or there's other interpretations of that as well. But I mean, like I said, Ovid's version is my favorite, and I think depending on your translation, it's pretty clear from that it was a violent attack by Poseidon.
Yeah, and it seems to, I mean, it's so interesting because there is this sense you get in the Greek world that it is dangerous to be too beautiful, because you might attract the jealousy or the wrong kind of attention from the gods, because the gods, of course, in this world are so imperfect, which is one of the things I love about them. It makes them so interesting. But it's quite horrific when you look at the male gods, particularly, you know, figures like Zeus and Poseidon. Like, they don't have a great track record when it comes to, you know, consensual sex and their relations with mortal women. But in some versions, one of the things that particularly attracts Poseidon's attention is the beautiful hair of Medusa.
Oh, yeah. And this is one of the other problems that we face with these kinds of stories is that the power imbalance is just too great. Like, there is no way that if you don't want to sleep with a god that you can actually put them off.
No.
You know, like, you have, like, the classic sort of tale of Apollo and Daphne, which opens Ovid's Metamorphoses. And she turns herself into a tree, essentially, to try and get away from this guy. And it's horrifying that, one, that the ancient writers recognized the power imbalance as such, and also noted really clearly that for women, this took a really particular turn really quickly. And it was assault.
Yeah, there are so many examples of women doing going to lengths like Daphne did, trying to get away. There's so many of where a woman ends up transforming herself into something else to get away from a god. And then, of course, it's turned into a, well, and that's how we have laurel trees. And then there's examples of, yeah, different, I think they're often transformed into plants to get away from the gods and things like that. But it's the lengths that women have to go to in Greek mythology to keep themselves from being assaulted by a god is pretty extensive.
And we also get the sense very clearly from what happens to Medusa after she seeks refuge in Athena's temple.
Mm.
And the rape still happens. And Athena basically turns on her. And this sort of sense in which the gods, regardless of gender, stick with each other.
I did actually hear someone suggest that Athena punished Medusa because her temple had been violated. You know, something that should not happen in her temple had happened. And she, obviously, it's difficult for her to punish someone like Poseidon. You know, he's just as powerful as she is, if not more so. He's one of the Olympian gods. Like, and so Medusa is the only other figure that she can punish in this story. Do you think that's what's going on here?
I feel like this sort of ties up nicely with things like the stories we get in the Iliad.
Yeah.
Where the gods basically use people as their pawns to enact their own types of vengeance.
Exactly, yes.
And so Medusa is the fall figure for getting at Poseidon because Poseidon was obviously interested in her.
Mm. And one of the unfortunate consequences of this rape, which won't 100% become clear until later in her story, is that Medusa does in fact become pregnant. She doesn't give birth to these, to her children, I suppose we'll call them, until her death. It's almost Zeus-like, the way that she gives birth to them, because Zeus famously, gives birth to Athena, through his head.
Incredible stuff,
yeah. Medusa has these children inside of her, one of which is a very obvious tie to Poseidon, the man that raped her, because Poseidon is also god of horses.
Liv, I'm gonna turn this one over to you. Tell us about these children.
This is my absolute favorite. I think it might be my all-time favorite like anecdote from Greek mythology. I tell it to complete strangers regularly, for good or bad. When Perseus eventually does come to kill Medusa and is able to cut off her head from the stump of her severed neck, fly out first Pegasus, the very famous flying horse, and Chrysaor, a man. Chrysaor doesn't have much of a story afterwards. You kind of just forget that he was there, and then Pegasus
is a disappointing aftermath. Yeah.
It's twins.
It's twins. Sort of.
Definitely fraternal. They don't look the same.
I always find that interesting because in some of the popular imaginings of Medusa's story, like the Clash of the Titans movies, Pegasus comes in before Medusa is killed. Like there's no clear connection between her and Pegasus. And I find that really interesting that that connection between Medusa and her offspring has been severed in modern retellings. I'm very curious to get both of your perspectives on this. I'll start with you, Liv. What do you think about the fact that they've reversed the order and forgotten that Medusa actually had children?
Again, a thing I talk about actually endlessly. Well, add to that that Perseus encounters what seems to be a herd of Pegasi, of flying horses, when that's not a thing in Greek mythology. There are select flying horses that were possessed by very select people. There is only one Pegasus. It is his name. It is a proper noun. It is not a breed of flying horse, which I could go on about forever. So it's truly one of my favorite things to rant about, that Pegasus is in The Clash of the Titans before Perseus kills Medusa. I also think that Pegasus is so widespread across modern representations but none of those representations actually have him being ridden and used by the hero who actually did ride him.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like Bellerophon might as well never exist. He doesn't even need to be a real person. Because it's the only hero that ever actually rode Pegasus, and yet, nowhere. Also, I do have to add the representation of the birth of Pegasus in Disney's Hercules. It's one of my favorite things to talk to people who their entire knowledge of Greek mythology is Disney's Hercules, and to say, like, oh, you know, remember when Zeus plucks clouds out of the sky and forms them into a little horse, and suddenly, poof, it's this adorable, cute little flying horse. Well, actually, no, this is how Pegasus was born.
That is my students' like favorite representation of a Greek myth, Disney's Hercules. And so they always think that Pegasus is somehow tied to Hercules and like his best friend. I'm like, no, no, he is not. Dr. G, what is your take on this reversal of birth?
Look, I'm shocked, utterly shocked. One, you've got the erasure of a woman's story and, you know, she becomes a mother. It's horrifying. She's carried around those children before birthing them from her neck for a long time. Mm. That is a big burden to carry around. And everybody just decides to forget that. And by displacing Pegasus out of that narrative and refusing to allow that to be, like Medusa to be a mother, it's really centering her as a figure of fear. She doesn't have any redeeming qualities in the way that her story has been taken up in the classical reception of it.
Yeah.
She's not allowed to be a complex figure. She has to be evil. She has to serve Perseus's purpose, and that's about it.
Yeah, because, I mean, the thing I find, I was watching yesterday a few representations of Medusa in film, so I watched a little bit of the original Clash of the Titans, 1981, and then the 2010 version of Clash of the Titans, and then I watched Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, and Medusa is in all of those because all of those stories have something to do with Perseus, the hero that eventually comes up against Medusa. And in all of them, it struck me that she, I mean, as you probably would expect from movies and visual representations like this, she is meant to be obviously scary, a monster, all of those sorts of things. But she's also got this real sexual quality. And I feel like because in Clash of the Titans, in both versions, it's not just her hair that's all filled with snakes. She's actually got a snake body as well. Like she's almost like a snake centaur. You know, her top half is like that of a woman, and then her bottom half is that of a snake. It's like a mermaid.
She's like a land mermaid.
Yeah, kind of like a land mermaid. Yeah, and she's always got this very sexual quality to her. And like even in Percy Jackson, it's Uma Thurman who plays Medusa.
Of course.
Yeah, and in all of them, she has this ability to turn, like when she's about to turn someone into stone, it's not just they look at her and they turn to stone. Her face transforms. It's like she turns on the tractor beams that are in her eyes and they glow, and her face often gets more monstrous and more scary, and the snakes all scream. It's all very terrifying. But I can almost see how they're like, oh, well, we can't have this figure also be a mother. That's too confusing. We need to have her just be a monster and just be something like sort of sexy scary.
There's beauty in her as well, right? But all the representations always show her as sort of horrific and terrifying. And so it's also that she can't be portrayed as beautiful. I mean, Athena made her have snake hair, but as far as I remember, she didn't make her ugly. She just made the thing that was her most beautiful feature sort of horrible. But she didn't change her from what she was before, which in some versions is a pretty human-looking person, but with snake hair, and then who turns people to stone. In much of the original Greek, all the Gorgons turn you to stone, and they're all pretty monstrous, and it's just the snake hair that she's given, so that's a little bit different. But certainly in Ovid, she's beautiful, and that is the issue, and it's just the hair that changes. But she would still be a beautiful woman that Perseus is there to kill in this. What I think that if you were to portray that in something today, it would be a lot more sympathetic to Medusa inherently, just, I mean, because of the value placed on beauty, unfortunately. But, you know, it would be a completely different thing to watch an actor come in and try and fight this woman who's just stunning and human looking and happens to have snake hair.
Well, that's what interested me actually in the Percy Jackson Uma Thurman version of the story, because they did in the original Clash of the Titans, when they had Medusa, they didn't actually have an actress play her. It's actually done by claymation. And she's very serpentine in that, you know, her whole, you know, her, the coloration of her whole body is like this, like, dark, scary green. She's got like very scaly skin covering her whole body. Then she's got like the tail instead, like this, and it's like, it's actually like a cobra tail. So when she's, there are occasional like,
she sounds irresistible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There are these occasional shots of the tail going,
oh, like a rattlesnake.
Like a rattlesnake. Sorry, yeah, not a cobra. Yeah, a rattlesnake. Yeah, and so it's really interesting to then go to the Uma Thurman version where she is this beautiful person, and when she's dealing with the people who are attacking her, she often comes right up to them and will say, you know, look at me, you can't avoid the temptation to look at me, which I think is going back to that idea of her being beautiful. But as you say, Ovid's version has been so influential, and Ovid was, I think, one of the ones that really emphasized her as being beautiful, and not just this creature, this creature, really, like this monstrous figure. And depending on the, when you look at the visual representations as well, because so many of them do focus on the head, you know, of Medusa, it becomes a little bit more... In some representations, it's a little bit more monstrous because they might focus on like her mouth like gaping open and her tongue protruding because she's obviously dead. So that's not necessarily the most attractive pose to take.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a bit of an issue. I mean, once you've had your head cut off, it's hard to look good.
Yeah. But I mean, one of the most famous representations, of course, of Medusa, like nowadays, like as just like the head of Medusa, the Gorgonian is the logo of Versace.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I'd love to get your take on that, Liv. What do you think of Versace using the Gorgonian as their logo?
So I'll start this by saying a little bit, or giving away a little bit about myself. I didn't know that for like a really long time, which just shows how much I've looked at Versace.
Yeah.
So
you don't have a whole cupboard full of Versace?
I really don't. So no, I think I found that out just maybe like in the last couple of years because somebody pointed it out to me. So... I mean, it's funny because there's another brand. It's probably pretty North American, but I just see it on people. It's called Crooks and Castles, and it's a very similar logo. And I don't know if they were taking Medusa as well or copying Versace, but they both use the very similar sort of that iconic Greek Medusa head. It seems odd to me that choice was made. I don't know if there's any kind of reasoning behind it or if they just... picked it, but I'll be honest, I don't have a huge opinion simply because I don't know enough about Versace, and I just kind of think, oh, that's kind of, I kind of wish that I, basically, if I see it, I think I just want something with Medusa on it, but I don't feel like I need to buy anything Versace. I just want the Medusa.
Well, I believe the choice was made because it was, they thought it would associate the brand with sort of, you know, danger and seduction. And
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. I've done some research into this, actually. Mm. So part of Gianni Versace's story is that he grows up in Reggio Calabria, which is basically in the toe of the boot. And from there you can see Sicily. One, there's a Medusa face on the Sicilian flag.
Yeah, so and there has been for a really long time. Where are we now? 2020, so like over 800 years.
Yeah, a long time. Yeah. And he also describes the inspiration for the logo as coming from a floor, so like a mosaic display that he saw in some ruins when he was a child where they used to play.
Yeah.
And that in itself makes a lot of sense because that part of southern Italy is also known as Magna Graecia.
Mm.
And that's where Greek colonists went and set up. And so there is a really strong Greek legacy in that whole region.
Mm.
But then further to that, to add to that kind of mythos, he actually also decided, apparently, and this is what he said, because he's also got... I mean, he's unfortunately dead now, but in his house, he also had Medusa imagery all over the place.
Mm.
And he was interested in this idea of the seduction of the pre-snake-headed Medusa.
Exactly.
Capacity to draw the gaze and for even the gods to be unable to look away.
Mm.
So there's something fatally attractive,
yes,
in what Medusa is bringing to the table. But then when we look at the logo itself, it very much resembles one that we've seen elsewhere. So now I flick through my notes because
it's the Medusa, the Rodanini, isn't it? That particular very famous head that was I think it was rediscovered in like the I think it was the 1700s, the 1800s. It was rediscovered, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it was certainly seen by Goethe. So
yeah.
When he went on his tour of Italy, he was just astounded by this Medusa Rodanini. And it's a head which is beautiful, and it seems like less snakes, and there's more like a couple of wings coming out of the top of the head.
Yeah.
And I'm always interested when we see that iconography, which is not snakes, but wings.
Mm, definitely, yeah.
Well, in the Greek, too, there's one that says she has tusks.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I just Googled it based on what you just said, because that is the one I'm familiar with. I just didn't know the name. But I almost wonder if they're sort of myth-shapen tusks.
Mm.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
But I kind of love the idea that maybe there would be tusks on the face as well, like, you know.
Yeah.
Rather than like horn-like sort of things. So I was like, oh, that's a whole new dimension.
I think there are lots of or some depictions of the wings as well, though, as part of it. And of course, now I'm just trying to think of them. But there are a lot of depictions of Medusa where she's got certainly more than just snakes, and that's sort of the
icon. True. Yeah, there are some versions, you're right, where she does have actual wings as well, which is interesting. But speaking of all these features of Medusa, and speaking of her head in particular, I feel like we need to tell our listeners how her head came to be separated from her body.
A disaster, truly.
Yeah, because this is obviously the story that we most see in connection with Medusa in our remaining sources, and that is the story of the hero Perseus. Liv, could you tell us a little bit about who Perseus is?
Oh, how much to say. Perseus is the son of Zeus, as most heroes are. He most notably was born via insemination via a shower of gold on his mother, Danae, which is always fascinating because Zeus has such creative ways of impregnating women. But, I mean, he has a long and harried story, but essentially he is attempting to save Andromeda from a sea monster when he goes in search of Medusa's head because it has the power to turn to stone. And so he's helped in that quest primarily by Athena, who always helps heroes, but also Athena brings him things from Hermes and Hades so that he has everything he needs in order to defeat Medusa and then therefore defeat, I believe it's Keto, that's the sea monster in that case.
Oh, now that's fascinating.
Because Keto is the mother of
Medusa. Keto is Medusa's mother.
Yeah.
Isn't Phorcus the mother, or is it Phorcus is the man?
No, that's a father. That's
okay,
a father.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, well then maybe, I wonder if it is Keto, but that's...
No, look, it's interesting because that is definitely a version of Perseus' story that we get, but there are other versions where Perseus' motivation seemed to me far less noble. And way more flimsy, I suppose, is the way I'm going to term them, which is that, as you said, quite rightly, Perseus being the son of Zeus, but he grows up not being aware of that for a while. And he and his mother are actually supposedly cast at sea when he is a very young child as a way of sort of getting rid of them, because there are dangerous stories told of what Perseus is going to do when he grows up, what he might accomplish against the ruling king. And of course, the ruling king is like, having none of that, but I'm not going to actually, you know, obviously kill you. So I'll leave your fate up to the gods. I'll chuck you in a wooden chest, chuck you in the sea, and, you know, hopefully that will be the end of you. And of course, it never is. Perseus and his mother, you know, wash ashore unharmed. And Perseus grows up not being 100% aware of his background. But when he does grow up, there is a story that he goes to a banquet with the king of the area. And the king of the area is getting all these, like, glorious gifts given to him by people around. And Perseus doesn't have anything to offer because he's grown up being, you know,
washed up in a sea chest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like a nobody. And so he is challenged, he's either challenged or he is somehow inspired to go and retrieve the head of Medusa, the head of the Gorgon, as an offering to this king, which would obviously be a super handy weapon because the head will still work even when separated from Medusa's body to, like, petrify people.
Look, I'm really curious that people think that's going to be true as well. Like, how do they know the head is going to be operational without the body?
Well, you know, this is. I mean, I think the idea is kind of to maybe get Perseus out of the way as well. You know, being a son of Zeus, you know, not great to maybe have in your area. So yeah, that to me is, like, horrifying, because Perseus has no real motivation that's, in my modern viewpoint, is valid. I totally get that
just go and chop off a woman's head. It doesn't really matter what your reasoning is, still not stacking up.
Well, I get in the ancient world, it's, you know, being a hero is about doing deeds that are worthy of admiration, worthy of you being remembered after you're dead. It's not about being a morally good person. I understand that. But from my modern viewpoint, I'm just like, really, Perseus? Really?
I think it's a problem, because what has Medusa really done to deserve this? She's been the victim of rape, and then she's just gone about her business.
Yeah, well, but she's had to go and live with the other two Gorgons, and where they live changes again on who you're reading, but it's pretty remote.
So they're often her sisters. So it's not always that she has to go live with them either. Like, they're typically her sisters. But also, thank you for that Perseus story, because I completely forgotten that version. And of course, as soon as you're speaking it, I was like, of course I know that one as well. There's too many myths in my head now. But that one is so much more fascinating, the idea that it's a lot like the hero Theseus, who does some awful things as well, just kind of for the sake of so-called heroic actions. But yeah, he was trying to be, or the attempt, the purpose was to have Perseus killed off, and of course instead he just arrives with the head, and then the king is killed off instead.
Yeah, well, he has to, obviously, I mean, like most heroes do, he has to overcome numerous obstacles before he actually faces Medusa herself, one of which is actually figuring out where she is, because she and her sisters are living in this very remote location, which is, you know, it kind of gives you the impression that they're at, like, the ends of the earth. But yeah, they're living in this remote location. Medusa, the mortal Gorgon, and the two other immortal Gorgons. And in order to figure out where they are located, Perseus has to go and see three other sisters, who I know that you're going to be a fan of, Liv, because they also feature in Disney's Hercules.
They're the best. What am I thinking? The Hercules, I know, conflates the two.
Grey Eye are these three sisters who are very, very old women. And they're so old that they only share between them one eye and one tooth.
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah.
Perseus manages to steal the eye from them, apparently, and basically hold it hostage until they reveal the location of the Gorgons. So horrible.
What an evil action. I mean, it's just so... Also, the visual's amazing. But yeah, I mean, God, Perseus just sounds like a real jerk.
I know. I agree. That's what I mean. The more you look into Perseus's tale from a modern point of view, the more he seems really objectionable.
The kind of guy you just don't want to meet at a party or to offer a dare to, because he'll take it way too seriously.
Oh, God. Yeah. It'd be awful.
Yeah, but he is also offered assistance by the gods, who are, of course, some of whom are related to him being...
Yeah, it seems like everybody wants Medusa dead.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so he ends up getting some help by getting the winged sandals of Hermes. He's given a gift of a particular kind of satchel, which is like a safe place to put a gorgon's head. You can imagine you don't come across them every day.
Keeps the blood in the bag.
Yeah, exactly, by Athena. He's also given this magnificent shield, which will come in handy, as it turns out, when he finally faces
Medusa. Okay, this reminds me of like one of my favorite childhood computer games, which was King's Quest. Ooh. And I know, right? And in one of these King's Quest games, you had to go into the desert with a mirror.
Right.
And you had to turn Medusa into stone.
Ooh.
By reflecting her gaze back at her.
Interesting.
In order to be able to pick up something in the desert.
Well, this
is stuck with me as being like, I mean, that's the ultimate fate, isn't it? Forget cutting off a head. Just reflect the gaze back and just eliminate the threat entirely.
I always get such like vivid Harry Potter memories of like the basilisk and people being petrified and like Hermione looking around the corner with a mirror when I think of Medusa's story now.
That's so true. I love that so much.
So eventually Perseus makes it to where Medusa and her Gorgon sisters are residing, and of course littered about the place are the people that have come across Medusa before, and as you
surprisingly say, quite a lot considering it's a remote region of the
exactly
Earth.
Yeah, so you'd imagine like fishermen and, you know, people, fools who think that they can be, you know, glorious heroes.
It's
as
a bit
well.
Like going to a modern nursery though, isn't it? I mean, there's the whole section with the statues and you're like, oh.
Yeah, so he turns up and he sees all these statues of people that have been petrified before. Now this is another part of the story that is a little confronting. But in representations of the story, both in some literary and in some artistic representations of the story, Medusa is actually sleeping. I think it is a popular artistic representation, but it is also in some of the literary versions where Perseus comes across the sleeping Gorgon and he cuts her head off while she is sleeping.
Oh, that's so much worse. That's so awful.
Or she's asleep and like her snakes start to wake up, or she starts to wake up. You know, that there's a couple of, I think, different ways of looking at it, but either way, you've essentially got this guy chopping off the head of a pretty defenseless woman in various versions of this. And I think that even in the ancient world they were somewhat uncomfortable with this idea, because it is a very confronting prospect.
Yeah Okay, well, like, taking into account that maybe she was sleeping in some of these versions, what versions, Liv, have you come across in terms of the actual moment, the tension between Perseus and Medusa in the moment leading up to her head being severed?
I don't know so much about versions necessarily, so much as theories. Just because, for one, I mean, it's interesting that he goes there in the first place. It just seems like everything is Medusa keeping to herself. She's not necessarily trying to hurt anyone, and yet everyone seems to want her killed, which I think is always a fascinating interpretation. And a lot of people over time have asked me whether Medusa's only turns men to stone. And I think that's a really interesting idea to look at, simply because I don't think that we have any way of knowing, because women would have never tried to go find her and kill her. It would have only been men who were feeling so, you know, whatever they feel that they need to for no real reason. They're not defending themselves in any way or saving anyone from her. They just feel the need to go to this remote location where she isn't harming anybody and kill her. And most of them turn to stone. And so, you know, yes, it's men that get turned to stone, but is that because only men will turn to stone, or is it because only men are, you know, feeling the need to go try?
Yeah, and we get a sense that, like, particularly from the Greek perspective, you don't have a lot of female hero figures.
No. I believe there are actually no recorded female victims of Medusa, though. There's no one
Which would make sense.
Yeah.
In a way, because as you say, Liv, like why would any woman go there? They're not expected to narratively. It doesn't conform with Greek expectations of how women would behave in this society. And we don't see a lot of like heroic female figures anyway. And so of that very small group, who would go there?
It's so interesting that you both mentioned this, because in the most recent version of Clash of the Titans, the one that came out in 2010, when Perseus is off on his quest, he ends up collecting a little band of helpers, from various areas. But one of them is a female called Io. And Io apparently also attracted the attention of Poseidon, and I get that. I think she's played by Gemma Arterton, so figures. And her as punishment for resisting him, and God knows how she managed to resist him, because we know Medusa didn't. She is made immortal, and she therefore has been watching over Perseus from the moment he's a child, and she's now with him on this journey. And as they're journeying to find Medusa, who is located in the depths of the underworld in a special temple.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, I know. So they're on the boat with Chiron, the ferryman, like on the river Styx.
Seems so unlikely.
Just Jamie getting started. Yeah. Anyway, she tells the story of Medusa's rape and how she was so unfairly punished by Athena. And then she says that I can accompany you to the temple, but I can't go inside, because the one thing that Athena did to Medusa to make her, I don't know, feel better, was that she would never be able to harm another woman, and therefore no woman could enter the temple to try and kill her.
I don't know if I buy that logic.
I don't get it either, but I'm just saying it's out there. It's part of the classical reception now.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the reason why this version of Medusa being sleeping, it really interested me, is because, you know me, Dr. G, fascination with movies. In the movies, she really is obviously they're going to her. They are taking the fight to her. But then once they're there, she is so aggressive. And that doesn't come across in the ancient material at all.
And I think this ties in really nicely to the really recent sculpture that we have from Luciano Gabbati from 2008, where, and it sort of did the rounds on social media a couple of years ago, and it's an oversized statue. She's about 2 meters tall, and it's Medusa. She's naked. She has a feminine body, and she's got the snakes, and she's holding the head of Perseus.
Ah, yes. And that's a reversal.
The sword in the other hand.
Yeah, that's a reversal of a very, very famous artistic representation of this story, which is Cellini's Perseus slaying Medusa, where Perseus is there in all his glory, you know, like the typical hero.
The heroic nude.
Yeah, the heroic nude, and he's holding out the head of Medusa.
And he's also standing on her body.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that has been reappropriated. Some of Donald Trump's supporters have put the head of Hillary Clinton on the head of Medusa. So that is a very famous representation. So it's so interesting that you've got this reversal. We're going to throw to you now, Liv. What do you think of all these artistic representations of Medusa?
I mean, I think that one's fascinating, and I love that it happened so recently. And especially just as the comparison to that more, or the certainly older and more famous one. People send me the new one all the time, and I'm always entertaining. But I think that one's fascinating because it really sort of takes back a level of power for Medusa, and just really makes her, I mean, the center, obviously, but then, of course, just the real hero. I mean, she's quite muscular. She's very fit. She's very put together. She's just sort of everything that the typical representations of Medusa aren't.
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting because, of course, in the 1960s, 1970s, you started to get this real interest in reappropriating a lot of things through like a feminist from a feminist perspective. So retelling fairy tales, for example, to put women in more powerful positions or just slightly altering the storyline. And myths got subject to that same treatment because they were seen as being kind of the same thing. I mean, obviously they're not. But so you do start to see people trying to sort of take back stories, which a lot of people have seen as being about putting women in their place. And I think it's so interesting to consider that with the story of Medusa, because Medusa seems to be a really ancient figure, you know, and it seems to be something that might even have spanned obviously more than just the Greek cultural context. It might also have come from like Arabic context and that sort of thing. And particularly like the idea of the Gorgonian being a sort of protective amulet or, you know, representation of some sort. And so there certainly have been suggestions that this story of Perseus slaying Medusa is in some way the patriarchy putting an older matriarchal like deity of some sort in its place. Mm. Particularly if you go to Rome and you look at, there's a particular temple that the Emperor Justinian built, and at the bottom of some of the columns, there are Medusa's head and they're turned on their side or they're turned upside down. Is that some sort of a statement about putting these old female-driven or female-centered religions in their place? Like, what is going on here? I'm going to throw to you first, Dr. G.
Oh, what is going on here? I think there's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
So we have a pretty good evidential basis to understand Medusa's story coming out of a broader Middle Eastern context.
Definitely.
The references that pop up in Homer are just sort of scratching the surface of how the Greeks are starting to get into this idea of this narrative.
Mm.
But this idea of powerful female figures who have to be eliminated, I think is... It's sad in a way because it leads us to a point where we're like, what does it mean to be part of the Western tradition? What does it mean to have our legacy as women be bound up in these kinds of stories?
Mm.
Because this is what's been set up for us in terms of like, what does your life look like? And if you're a Medusa figure, you have all of the advantages initially of the things that a patriarchal society values, which essentially is just beauty. And then to have that used against you by a more powerful figure, for that to then become a victim-blaming narrative where you're punished again, for that to lead you to seclusion, essentially, where you go and live with your sisters at the far edges of the world because you're traumatized by what has happened to you and weird stuff is now happening to your body, which you can't do anything about. It just seems that when you look at things, they turn to stone. What are you supposed to do with that?
Mm.
She sort of takes herself away and removes herself as far as possible to sort of limit that damage.
And that's, she does not give birth to those children.
Doesn't give birth to those children. No. And that's kind of an amazing sort of like resistance narrative in a way. How are these children ever supposed to be born? I mean, most mortal women who fall pregnant to gods give birth within a reasonable time frame.
Yep.
Medusa does not. What does that say about her power? Is this a connection to a broader, older story? And then to, after going into that sort of seclusion and just trying to deal with whatever it is that she has to deal with, for then men to just come at her to try and kill her. And it's like, it just doesn't stop. And it makes me incredibly sad when I start to think about the story that way.
Mm. Liv, what's your take?
Well, that part, that's absolutely fascinating listening to it from that perspective. I think it's interesting to also examine the idea that people have brought up to me the possibility, or there's been sort of memes even floating around of this, but the idea that she wasn't... punished by Athena so much as saved or just kept from further harm in that way. And so I almost wonder whether you could see the interpretation that we have now of, you know, her becoming this sort of evil figure and Perseus coming to just do away with her as the Greeks' interpretation on possibly an older story, like you're saying, where the older story might have suggested that Athena turning Medusa into what she was, and secluding her in this place was actually a protection, where if she didn't have that beautiful hair, then maybe no other gods would come to try to rape her. And if she was in this secluded area, then they certainly couldn't get to her, even if they had wanted to try. And so there's an argument to be made that Athena could have been helping Medusa. I think that most of the interpretations we have of Athena are pretty based in that patriarchal Greek world, and Athena is typically helping the men and harming the women. So it's hard to say, but, you know, maybe it is sort of based in that, in an older story.
That is interesting that you say, because, of course, one of the, well, the place that's probably most famous that Medusa's head ends up is, of course, on Athena's breastplate. It's one of the things that when, you know, when Perseus has done his deed and earned his heroic status, he does make use of Medusa's head in a couple of subsequent conflicts of his own. But then he gives back, you know, the gifts that the gods gave him, one of which is the weapon of Medusa's head. I think the great thing about myth, and this might be a good point to start wrapping up our discussion, is that unlike historical events and figures, myth, even in the ancient world, was something that was meant to be adapted depending on what you were trying to say and your context. So that's why when we look at the artistic representation, although people like Furtwängler tried to have this really linear narrative where you go from a more terrifying version of Medusa into this more beautiful, you know, Ovid-influenced version of Medusa, we know that it's a lot more messy than that. We know that there are overlapping traditions. We know that people could choose to portray her in various ways, like some more beautiful, some more monstrous, depending on what it was they were constructing. I mean, some even comedic. You know, you might even get like one of those cups where as you were drinking, you know, you get the face of the gorgon at the bottom so that you're like, ah, once you run out of wine. So there are all sorts of different ways of representing Medusa in the ancient world. And she's definitely someone who I think will continually be adapted in the modern world. I mean, you know, she pops up in Karl Marx, her head being like the symbol of social injustice. Her head was used famously during the French Revolution by the Jacobites.
Yeah. Sigmund Freud gets in
Sigmund
on
Freud,
it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. This this fear of castration, apparently, that men have when, you know, they first see female genitalia for the first time. So there's just...
What better way to navigate that than to cut off a woman's head?
I don't even want to. I was so confused by that at first until I started thinking about, you know, erections and, you know, being petrified and just don't. I'm like, you wish, Sigmund Freud. Anyway, so there's so many different versions of her, and they will only continue to keep being adapted. And of course, you know, most famously in terms of feminist readings, Hélène Cécu, I think it is. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I apologize.
The French one.
Yeah, exactly. With the laughing head of Medusa as being a way of smashing the patriarchy.
Ooh.
Yeah. Nice. So it's so interesting, and there's just so much out there. So we're definitely going to be providing a bibliography for people who maybe want to read up on this more, because we can't possibly talk about everything in detail. Any final thoughts from you, Dr. G? Any takeaways from Medusa's stories?
I think there is a continuing fascination because it combines together beauty and terror. And that juxtaposition, it's hard to look away from her story in the same way that you're concerned about the petrification that could happen to you if you engage with that narrative. And it's almost like it's a quintessential understanding of womanhood in ancient Greece in particular. Yeah, so for me, it's like it continues to be fascinating because it's got so much scope for adaptation, and it combines together some things that we really just can't ignore. It speaks differently to different generations as well. And I love that about myth. I love that about
history. I can't believe I actually got to mention Assassin's Creed and her featuring in there as well.
Like, okay. Yeah. All right. Ooh.
But in that version, this is really interesting to me. Her transformation comes about because of her exposure to like an Assassin's Creed thing, like the Apple of Eden.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that takes away, you know, like her backstory.
You know, I really resisted buying that part of Assassin's Creed Odyssey, but maybe I should.
Well, there you go. Live. that's your final takeaway from the story of Medusa?
I mean, I think it's most fascinating, one of the most fascinating stories in mythology, just because of exactly what you both have said already, of the ways in which it can be interpreted and the ways in which it kind of evolves as culture evolves, the way we can see it differently throughout time. And I did just want to note two of my favorite representations of her from just the art world and a similar time period, and I find them fascinating because they're so different. Caravaggio's Medusa is it's so famous. It's such an incredible representation of her, so visceral and awful. And then Bernini, who was only shortly after Caravaggio in time, has this sculpture of her that is so sympathetic. And I think it's one of the very few sympathetic takes on Medusa, certainly from, you know, earlier time periods, less so now. But she just is so sad in the Bernini version. And it's that just the comparison of their very similar time frames, the two artists, and to have the Caravaggio so famous, it's just such a, it's so painful to look at. And then the Bernini's is just so sad. And I just find them it all fascinating. But those two and their similarities are interesting to me.
Oh, and I love how much, I mean, I'm so glad you brought up the Caravaggio, because that's another one that has been repurposed in recent years in anti-Hillary Clinton and anti-Angela Merkel propaganda. And it's just so interesting. I mean, especially when you think back to the original ones of those, like Caravaggio's early artwork, and if you also think back to the Cellini Perseus slays Medusa statue that we were thinking of, because that, of course, in its original context was all about politics. It was all about the Medici and their monopoly over Florence, and its positioning was opposite the David, a stone statue. You know, if you look at the original context of all these artworks and what those artists are trying to say, they're a story unto themselves. But the fact that they choose Medusa,
it sounds like a trip to Florence is in order, because the Cellini and the Caravaggio are both in Florence.
There you go. Road trip. Thank you so much, Liv, for joining us and talking about all things Medusa. Where can our listeners find you and your wonderful podcast?
Well, thank you for having me. My podcast, Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, can be found everywhere you listen to podcasts. It's available everywhere. And then, in terms of social media, I'm Myths Baby everywhere.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure to chat Medusa with you.
Thank you. Yeah, any excuse to talk Medusa, it's amazing.
Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of The Partial Historians with Liv from Let's Talk About Miss Baby. We'd like to send a huge thank you to our patrons who enhance the capacity for us to produce a high quality podcast. Our thanks go to Sean, Roman, Savannah, Dana, Tamara, Justine, Theodore, Gunnar, CW, Sharon, Joel, Zara, Adri, Paul, Mark, Jacob, Nick, and last but definitely not least, our patron who changed their handle on Patreon to Augustus Rules, Tiberius Drools. We hear you, and we're here for that sort of content. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.